A drone strike authorized by President Trump killed Iran's top security and intelligence commander, Qasem Soleimani. Former CIA Director David Petraeus says this is a very big deal.
It is impossible to overstate the significance of this action. This is much more substantial than the killing of Osama bin Laden.
World leaders like Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are also reacting.
President Trump deserves all the credit for acting swiftly, forcefully, decisively. Israel stands with the United States.
Also, what to expect with climate change in the new year. More heat for the planet and the courts.
Litigation in the field of climate change has grown significantly in recent years, and it's anticipated that it will continue to grow.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. The news of the American attack that killed a top general in Iran is historic and could be a game changer for politics in the Mideast. We're going to look at the death of General Qasem Soleimani from several angles on the show today. And we start with the world's Shirin Jafari, who's been following the story since the first alerts came from Baghdad last night, East Coast time. Shirin, what is the latest about General Soleimani's death? What do we know?
Well, the Pentagon says he was killed in an American drone strike in Baghdad. Qasem Soleimani had arrived at Baghdad airport last night. He got into a car with several other people, including a guy called Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. He was the leader of a prominent Shia militia group in Iraq. And as their car left the airport, it was hit and all of the passengers died as a result. We've seen photos of the scene online, and in one of them, there's a severed hand, which is believed to be Soleimani's because he's wearing his signature ring, which has a big red stone on it.
Why did the U.S. go after Soleimani? And why was Soleimani, this Iranian commander, in Iraq in the first place?
So the U.S. has for a long time considered Qasem Soleimani as an enemy. The Pentagon has said in its statement that Soleimani and his supporters were responsible for the death and injury of hundreds of American and coalition forces, mostly in Iraq. In 2011, the U.S. Treasury put sanctions on Soleimani because it said he was involved in a plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., and he was planning to do that on U.S. soil. Mm. So it's fair to say that he was on the American government's radar for a while.
Now, Soleimani was a general in Iran's military, but my understanding is his status really went beyond that of a top military commander, right?
Absolutely. Qasem Soleimani was probably the most powerful military leader in Iran. He was 62 years old and he was the head of what's known as the Quds Force. That's an elite unit that operates outside of Iran's borders. And because of that, Soleimani had a lot of influence, not just in Iran, but also in places like Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and even with the Palestinians. But again, as far as the U.S. officials are concerned, Soleimani was really an international terrorist. Here is some of what Senator Mitch McConnell had to say about him today.
The architect and chief engineer for the world's most active state sponsor of terrorism has been removed.
Shirin, this has to be a serious blow to Iran's military. Why was Soleimani so influential in Iran?
I mean, his military career began in the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. He fought against Saddam Hussein's forces, and he was seen as a fearless and heroic figure. After the war, he found his way into influential circles in the Iranian establishment. And more recently, Soleimani organized Shia militia groups in places like Iraq and Syria who fought and helped defeat ISIS.
The world's Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed on this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Let's now turn to an American who fought against Qasem Soleimani's forces, retired U.S. Army General David Petraeus. Petraeus is a former director of the CIA and was commander of U.S. forces during some of the most critical years in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, he was our most significant Iranian adversary during my 4 years in Iraq, certainly when I was the Central Command commander, and very much so when I was the director of the CIA. He is unquestionably the most significant and important, or was the most significant and important Iranian figure in the region. It is impossible to overstate the significance of this action. This is much more substantial than the killing of Osama bin Laden. It's even more substantial than the killing of Baghdadi.
General Petraeus, did you ever interact directly or indirectly with him?
Indirectly, he sent a message to me through the president of Iraq in late March of 2008 during the Battle of Basra, when we were supporting the Iraqi army forces that were battling the Shia militias in Basra that were supported, of course, by Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force. He sent a message that said, "General Petraeus, you should know that I, Qasem Soleimani, control the policy of Iran for Iraq and also for Syria, Lebanon, Gaza, and Afghanistan." And the implication of that was that if you want to deal with Iran to resolve this situation in Basra, that you should deal with me, not with the Iranian diplomats. And his power only grew from that point in time. By the way, I actually told Qasem Soleimani to pound sand.
General Petraeus, did you have opportunities to hit Soleimani during your time in Iraq or CENTCOM or at the CIA, and did you take them?
Not when I was in Iraq. He never set foot in Iraq. I think he understood the threats that existed. I can't say what we might have contemplated as the CIA director. I obviously can't speak about what we might have considered relative to Qasem Soleimani, but he obviously was, again, a hugely harmful and a very capable adversary. He has the blood of hundreds of American soldiers on his hands, as well as the blood of many, many of our coalition and Iraqi partners, and those also in Syria, Lebanon, and Afghanistan, for that matter, and Yemen.
So why do you suppose this happened now, though?
Well, I suspect that the leaders in Washington were seeking to reestablish deterrence, which clearly had eroded to some degree, perhaps by the relatively insignificant actions in response to the strikes on the oil facility in Saudi Arabia, the shipping in the Gulf, and our $130 million drone that was shot down. And we had seen increased numbers of attacks against U.S. forces in Iraq. So I'm sure that there was a lot of discussion about what could show the Iranians most significantly that we are really serious, that they should not continue to escalate. Now, obviously, there is a menu of options that they have now, not just in terms of direct Iranian action against perhaps our large bases in the various Gulf states, shipping in the Gulf, but also through proxy actions, and not just in the region, but even in places such as Latin America and Africa and Europe.
Would you have recommended this course of action right now?
I hesitate to answer that just because I am not privy to the intelligence that was the foundation for the decision, which clearly was, as was announced, that this was a defensive action, that Soleimani was going into the country to presumably approve further attacks. Without really being in the inner circle on that, I think it's very difficult to either second guess or to even think through what a recommendation might have been.
Two short questions for what next, General Petraeus? U.S. remaining in Iraq and war with Iran. What's your best guess?
Well, I think one of the questions is, what will the diplomatic ramifications of this be? And again, there have been celebrations in some places in Iraq at the loss of Qasem Soleimani, and certainly the U.S., I would assume, is considering diplomatic initiatives as well, reaching out and saying, okay, does that send a sufficient message of our seriousness? Now would you like to return to the table? So lots of calculations here.
Do you have confidence in this administration to kind of navigate all those calculations?
Well, I think that this particular episode has been fairly impressively handled. There's been restraint in the some of the communications methods from the White House. The Department of Defense put out, I think, a solid statement. It has taken significant actions to shore up our defenses and our offensive capabilities. The question now, I think, is what is the diplomatic initiative that follows this?
The flag that Donald Trump posted last night, no words, was that restraint, do you think?
I think it was. Certainly, all things are relative, and I think relative to some of his tweets, that was quite restrained.
General David Petraeus was director of the CIA and commander of U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's really great to have you with us today. Thank you so much.
The pleasure was mine, Marco.
Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
In Iran, state television interrupted its regular programming to announce the death of Qassem Soleimani. Later, Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei called for 3 days of national mourning and, quote, severe retaliation. Nasser Hadian teaches international relations at Tehran University. He told me about the reaction inside Iran to Soleimani's death.
I can say among the average Iranian, possibly it's like a state of shock. But among the elite, it is both a shock and also what should be a response. I don't want to say many, but quite a number of good people expected that would happen in the future. And he himself was ready for that scenario. He himself was very much ready for what happened. But still, average citizens are shocked and they couldn't believe.
Help us understand, first of all, the shock. What did General Soleimani represent to the majority of the Iranian people?
You know, I can say in the last century, arguably, he's the most important soldier. I just cannot think of anyone under the previous regime and this current government, anyone come even close to his status. Former Revolutionary Guard commanders, even in the time of the war.
That would be the Iran-Iraq War in the 80s.
Yes. Former army commanders, I just cannot think of any of them come even close to his status as a national hero, as a soldier. Although there are criticism of basically a number of things we are doing in the region, but still the people to a large extent distinguish our policy from the persona of General Soleimani.
As I understand it, Mr. Hadian, Soleimani was very close to the Supreme Leader of Iran. Has the Supreme Leader commented publicly yet?
Yes, I mean, he was very close to him. And, you know, that was like a tragedy for him. But, you know, we are talking about the Quds Force. Yes, no doubt he was a very important persona. And that would be hard to substitute him in the short term. But no doubt he appointed very quickly someone who is relatively well informed of these situations. And he would follow suit, but I doubt he will be as successful as him, at least in the short term. We were not under any illusion that if the Americans, if they want to assassinate him, they can. The reasons that they don't do it is because of the consequences.
Well, let's talk about those consequences, because there are now 3 days of national mourning, and then I think everybody's going to wait and see what happens. What are you hearing from Iranian leaders about response to this or some kind of retaliation?
To be frank with you, I'm much more worried about next 3 days, because the way the elite, the government officials, these people are talking, you know, they're putting themselves in a corner that they have to do something. But after 3-4 days, the decisions on the part of Iranian at least will be more strategically calculated, and cooler mind will prevail.
As you've spoken with your fellow Iranians, is there a widespread hunger for retaliation, or is it more of a widespread concern for the consequences of retaliation?
You know, first of all, as I say, I would like to see for next 3-4 days we don't do anything. You know, we have been able to overcome a number of things which have happened in the last few months which have not been pleasant. I mean, let's keep, at least people like me can talk, let's keep this unity. Let's not act now.
I see that Qassem Soleimani has been replaced already, a man named Ismail Ani. What can you tell us about him? What do you know?
I don't know him personally, but, you know, he has been his deputy for a long time. He's well informed of the situation. But as I said, you know, that would take time for him to gain the same skills, same knowledge of Qassem Soleimani. So that would be very difficult job for any individual.
Nasser Hadian teaches international relations at Tehran University. He's been speaking with us from Tehran. Mr. Hadian, thank you very much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Bye-bye.
China's crackdown on ethnic Uyghurs is increasingly clear. As many as 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities are being held in what China calls re-education camps. But recent documents suggest the policy is even more draconian. The Chinese leadership is intent on crushing any hint of separatist movements. These policies have divided countless families. In Turkey, dozens of Uyghur children are being cared for at a boarding school while their parents are trapped back in China. Duri Baskaran reports from Istanbul.
The 11-year-old boy has a slight frame, but a wide smile. His favorite class at school is art. His favorite dinner is chicken with noodles. And when I ask him to introduce himself, this is the first thing on his mind.
I wish freedom for my country, and I want to fight for the freedom of my country.
The country he's referring to is East Turkestan, the term many Uyghurs use to describe China's northwestern Xinjiang province and their hopes for its independence. Here in Istanbul, thousands of miles away, 33 boys live in a boarding school for Uyghur children who have been separated from their parents. Mohammed Izatullah is in charge of caring for the children's daily needs. He says in most cases, the children arrived in Turkey with their parents for what was supposed to be a temporary visit. When the parents realized how bad things were getting in Xinjiang, they returned to China to get their affairs in order.
They decide to put their children to someone they know and go back and try to sell their houses, their business, collect all their value and come back.
But once they returned to China, the parents were detained.
They never come back.
Uyghur community leaders say up to 400 children are here in Turkey without their parents. These 33 boys were the first to attend the school because their living situations were considered the most unstable. In the dormitory, bunk beds sleep four boys to a room. A list of chores is on the wall. Izatullah tells me that the staff here avoid talking to the kids about what's happening to their parents back in China, but that doesn't keep the boys from worrying.
Sometimes they isolate themselves and really sad about it. He tried everything he can to help them, but actually he don't really know what to do, and it happens a lot.
Usually he takes them aside, tries to kick around a ball and get their mind off of it. If all else fails, he takes them to the mall for ice cream, a new toy, anything.
It was especially difficult in the beginning, but by the time they start to get used to it, and it's getting a little bit better.
Izatullah knows the pain of separation. He's also alone in Turkey. His wife and 9-year-old daughter are thousands of miles away in Xinjiang.
They had bought the flight ticket, but suddenly government start collecting all passports from Uyghurs. That's how they stuck.
Taking care of the kids here, he says, is one way he can feel normal. As the sun sets, a group of girls play a duck-duck-goose game with the teacher. About 100 children are non-boarding students who take Uyghur classes here. They stay with relatives nearby. Iman Yakub is raising two of his grandchildren. He has a shop where he sells fruit and vegetables that are hard to come by in Turkey, like Chinese long beans and chives. It's not easy compared to the comfortable life he used to lead in China, but nothing compares to how hard it is for him and his wife to be parents to their grandkids.
Yeah, we try to take care of them as good as we can, but of course we can never do the same as their own parents.
The children's parents and two brothers are still in China, he says.
Actually, we have never told them the true story. We always try to tell them that one day they will come here. Don't worry.
His 8-year-old granddaughter is a bit shy, but she tells me she likes school. Math is her favorite subject.
She likes to play with her friend and doing homework together, singing together.
Uyghur community leaders say that as far as they know, this boarding school is the only one of its kind. The school stays afloat with donations from a group of Uyghur businessmen that the director, Habibullah Kusemi, prefers not to name. As for the children themselves, he says, he worries about their safety all the time.
We know there have been statements from Chinese police that wherever we are in the world, they will reach them and put them back in the jail.
It's impossible to keep something like this a secret, he says. The location of the school, the identities of the kids, they have to assume the government knows everything.
So we worry. We do everything we can to keep them safe.
Most of the children here know that their parents are detained in camps, Kusemi says. In some cases, they've received word that their parents have died in custody. And that puts a big question mark on their future. Without their parents, living alone in a foreign country, what are their options? As the kids gather for dinner, Kusemi says his goal is to keep the students housed and cared for until they can go to university.
We have a responsibility to the nation to keep our identity, and the language is the most important element to keep our national identity.
Without that, he says, we wouldn't be Uyghurs anymore. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
10 Downing Street is hiring, so what qualifications do you think you might need to work in the government of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson? The World's Jonathan Dyer has been looking into that.
Just what does it take to get a job inside number 10 Downing Street these days? A degree from Oxford University? An expensive education from Eton? A few years at a government think tank, perhaps? The British political establishment is in what we Brits might call a right old tizzy today, after a blog post written by Boris Johnson's chief advisor went viral across the pond. The advisor, Dominic Cummings, called for weirdos and misfits with odd skills to apply for number 10 jobs. He went on, "We need some true wildcards, artists, people who never went to university and fought their way out of an appalling hellhole. Weirdos from William Gibson novels, like that girl hired by Big End as a brand diviner who feels sick at the sight of Tommy Hilfiger, or that Chinese-Cuban freerunner from a crime family hired by the KGB," end quote. If you think you need to be British to understand that, nope, not a clue. Applicants are instructed to send a one-page email outlining their ideas to ideasfornumber10@gmail.com. Yes, a Gmail address, with the subject line, job. Good luck. For The World, I'm Jonathan Dyer.
Iraqis were starting to come out of the darkness of war. There was some light at the end of the tunnel, and then an assassination on Iraqi soil.
It was an Iranian that was targeted. It was American that attacked, but it happened in Baghdad. Iraq doesn't deserve to be in the middle of this.
Iraqis react to the conflict between the U.S. and Iran. That's coming up on The World. Iran is processing the loss of its most revered general. In the 22 years he commanded the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's elite Quds Force, General Qasem Soleimani was not only in charge of spreading the Islamic Revolution outside the borders of Iran, he was the mastermind behind expanding it. He was brutal, but also someone many Iranians considered on par with leaders like General George S. Patton. Earlier, we were speaking about how invaluable General Soleimani was to Iran's military strategy and operations. So what happens now? Iranian leaders are firing dangerous threats of retaliation against the U.S. and its allies, and there are reports of thousands of additional U.S. troops being deployed to the Middle East. The eyes of the world are now on Tehran. Suzanne Maloney is the deputy director of the Brookings Center for Middle East Policy. She's in Washington. How big of a blow is General Soleimani's death to Iran's leadership, do you think? And what does this mean now for military strategy in Tehran?
Well, I think it's a significant blow. Soleimani was an iconic figure. He was the symbol of Iran's military prowess abroad. It's going to have a real impact on Iran's internal coherence, and this has set the regime, I think, back on its heels, at least briefly.
So what does Soleimani's death mean for Iran's militant policies and operations in the region, in places other than Iraq, say Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen?
Well, Soleimani had deep ties across the region, a long history, but he wasn't a solo operator. We shouldn't sort of foster the notion that Soleimani himself was personally irreplaceable. And I suspect that we'll see business as usual for Iran's regional expansionism and its involvement in military conflicts around the Middle East.
Right. So you think that'll continue? General Soleimani was considered an extremely dangerous commander. He was also considered to be fairly predictable and cautious. Do you think Iran will be able to contain any escalation of its response now?
I think, in fact, Iran will seek to calibrate its response, to wait for a time and place of its choosing where it can exact the maximum damage, both personally against the Trump administration, against American interest, but also seek to enhance their own leverage. This is a regime and a leadership that operates with one overriding priority, and that's the preservation of their power. And we don't see recklessness or indiscriminate reprisals. We've seen that Iran has waited, it's bided its time, and it's looked for the most effective opportunity to wreak its vengeance.
An Iranian analyst we spoke with earlier on the show today says he's most concerned about the next 3 days, these 3 days of mourning, that perhaps in this time Iran might just get trigger happy and shoot from the hip.
It's always a possibility, but my sense is that the Iranian leadership is going to use this 3-day public mourning period as an opportunity to stoke nationalist sentiment at home. The real danger now is, of course, that both sides have taken more escalatory steps. And even if President Trump doesn't want to go to war in an election year because he recognizes that it's not particularly popular with the American people, and even if Iranian leaders appreciate that they stand no real chance of a conventional face-off with a superpower at this stage, we are in a position where the escalatory spiral has begun to speed up and move in a direction that may no longer be easily controlled by either side.
With Israel temporarily shutting down its national ski resort near the border with Syria, how worried should they be of Iranian retaliation?
I think the Israelis are quite wise to take precautions, and I would imagine that other regional allies of the United States will take similar precautions as well.
So Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei named the deputy commander of the Quds Force. His name is Brigadier General Ismail Ghani. He's General Soleimani's replacement now. What do you know about him?
Ghani has a similar background to Soleimani. He has a long service in the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, is well known, doesn't appear to have the same degree of personal charisma and public persona that Soleimani very carefully nurtured, but he has been directly engaged in politics for quite a long time in Iran. You know, I think this is not a softer, kinder, gentler version of Soleimani, and he is likely to continue to be effective.
And knowing what you know about him, just today he said, quote, shortly you will see American bodies all across the Middle East, end quote. For a man like that, is that bluster?
No, it's not bluster. Iran makes good on the threats that it articulates. We saw this over the course of the past several months where Iran repeatedly said that if they could not export their oil, that their neighbors would not be able to either. And they made good on that threat in September by taking out the most significant oil processing facility in Saudi Arabia.
Suzanne Maloney, Deputy Director at the Brookings Center for Middle East Policy. Thank you.
Thank you.
One of the countries that is most impacted by the assassination of Soleimani is Iraq. He was killed at the Baghdad airport. After a tense few days following that protest at the U.S. embassy, the city finally seemed to have calmed down. Iraqi political analyst Hamza Haddad tweeted this, "A typical Thursday night in Baghdad, far from politics, the streets are busy and life continues." A few hours later, the attack. I asked Hamza for his reaction to the drone strike that killed General Soleimani.
I was out last night. It was busy. Things were normal. Came home after that. And around 1 a.m, I saw the reports about attack near Baghdad International Airport. At first, reports were coming out that it could have been Iranian rockets near the American base. And then they were starting with reports coming out saying it was actually the Americans targeting. And then in the morning, I had saw the news that it was Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis that died. So my tweet says true, like Baghdad itself was very normal that night. But you know, airport, more on the outskirts of the city, that's where it happened. And again, today, I was out in the afternoon. It's a lot quieter. Baghdad is eerily calm. So that you can definitely see a different sense in that aspect.
And why do you think it is so calm?
I mean, it's a weekend on Friday here in Baghdad. It's odd. The Iraqis have a high tolerance to violence after 40 years of conflict, but they also have experience now when things will get messy, and there's definitely that feel in the air of uncertainty of what will happen next.
Hamza, you later tweeted after the attack, "Iraq doesn't deserve this." Elaborate, if you would, on that. What do you mean?
I mean, it was an Iranian that was targeted. It was American that attacked, but it happened in Baghdad. And that's kind of what I meant, is Iraq doesn't deserve to be in the middle of this. We've consistently been finding ourselves in that position post-2003. We've had different prime ministers that have done different jobs in balancing that act, but we've kind of seen this unravel in the past year with Adel Abdelmehdi's government.
So what have you heard or maybe read announcements from any Iraqi officials on this?
All Iraqi officials that have been coming out have actually been playing the same line, have come out, denounced this. This is an attack on Iraq's sovereignty, whether it's the clergy in Najaf or any political party that's come out and condemned this action. They've actually had all the same statement, which kind of shows that this attack could be miscalculated. Now the question is, tomorrow we're going to have a parliament session about the status of coalition troops being in Iraq. And if all the political parties are tweeting statements that are the same, then it looks like they're all in line with ending that agreement with the United States.
Right. And this is not the first time this is being discussed. Parliament in Baghdad had already been considering kicking out U.S. forces even before the attack last night. So what do you think this attack means for U.S.-Iraq relations?
It's not just U.S.-Iraq relations. I think it's Western relations altogether that face uncertainty, because a lot of European states are here based on U.S. leadership. And, you know, if U.S.-Iraqi relations changes after today, then I think it's more than just, it's not just Washington, Baghdad, but other capitals as well that we'll see a shift in relations.
And if U.S. troops do go, what would that mean for Iraqi security? And what would it mean for your own security?
That's the uncertainty that we have. Baghdad finally started to see some normality in the past 2 years. The streets started to get busier. People were safe again to go out. And then just when you feel like there's a sense of hope, you get your two main allies bumping heads more than usual. So that's kind of the disheartening aspect out of all of this, was after all the sacrifices Iraqi security officials put in, not only to defeat Daesh, but to also regain the trust amongst Iraqi citizens, is in jeopardy again.
Hamza, how worried are you about the future? I mean, having seen what you've seen so far since the U.S. invasion in 2003, are you worried things could get even worse than during the thick of the war, say in 05 and 06?
It's a little weird, I mean, to kind of compare the two, because the situation on the street during the sectarian violence 2005 to 2009 was much more in your face as a citizen. Like I had been tweeting, things are still quite normal, so it's hard to kind of compare those two things. But there's definitely a bigger regional impact that's going to happen. And that's the uncertainty and fear that I think everyone has, including myself.
Hamza Haddad is an independent political analyst. He's been speaking with us from Baghdad. Thank you very much, Hamza.
Thank you for having me.
This week, we've been looking ahead at what to expect in 2020 when it comes to climate change. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, has one word: lawsuits.
In September of 2009, Typhoon Kitsana dumped a foot and a half of rain on the Philippines in just 24 hours. In the capital, Manila, muddy, sewage-filled floodwater trapped Derek Cabe's family on the roof of their home.
My family huddled together on the rooftop of our two-story house. As the floodwater swept past, they can see bodies, animals, and even a coffin. It was like a horror movie.
Cabe was trapped a few miles away with one of her sisters. She was getting text message updates from her family at home, but she couldn't get to them.
The fact that they were trapped in a life and death situation, and I have no idea how to help them, was the worst nightmare I've ever had.
When the floodwaters receded, their home and everything in it was covered in a thick layer of mud.
The home was destroyed. We have nothing. Nothing was left.
Since that day, the Philippines has been slammed by storms again and again. In 2012, Tropical Storm Washi killed about 1,300 people. In 2013, Typhoon Haiyan killed 6,000 people. These kinds of storms are expected to grow more intense as the climate warms.
What are we going to do? Are we just going to count the dead bodies? Are we just going to cry? Is that the only thing that we could do? there should be someone that should be accountable to this.
Someone held accountable. In 2015, Kabe signed on to a petition that asked the Philippines Commission on Human Rights to do just that. The commission investigated whether big oil and gas companies could be held legally responsible for harm caused by climate change. And the case is not unique. Citizens, nonprofits, and even governments around the world are increasingly turning to the courts to hold someone accountable for global warming.
Litigation in the field of climate change has grown significantly in recent years.
Alice Hill is a former judge and climate change policy expert at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And it's anticipated that it will continue to grow on a number of fronts as we experience more impacts and there's greater anxiety about the very urgent need to cut emissions.
Hill calls some of these climate change lawsuits failure to adapt cases. The plaintiffs are suing governments or businesses for not doing enough to protect people or their property from the impacts of climate change. In Texas, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers just fought and lost a case filed by homeowners claiming they didn't do enough to prevent flooding during Hurricane Harvey.
It's those types of cases that will just be replicated across the nation because the damages are happening and the courts are one of the most frequently sought-after places for people to get money.
Lawsuits against oil and gas companies are also on the rise. Right now, U.S. cities and states are suing for money to protect themselves from the impacts of climate change by building seawalls, for example. So far, none of those cases have been successful.
We see in these large-scale cases the fossil fuel companies raising the issue that, look, everyone's emitting carbon, and to point your finger at the fossil fuel companies isn't really fair, and you can't trace our emissions to a particular event, which is a linkage typically required in many tort cases.
Climate change lawsuits started, where else? Here, in the litigious United States, back in the late 1990s. For years, most of these cases were in the U.S. Joanna Setzer is a climate litigation expert at the London School of Economics. She says that started to change around 2015, after a Dutch court ruled that the government had to cut emissions to protect the human rights of its citizens.
What happened was a number of other countries and litigants started seeing how litigation could be used strategically against governments and against companies. So in Belgium, in Germany, in Luxembourg, in Chile.
Setzer says the trend is likely to continue in the upcoming year, especially in developing countries.
I expect to see more cases being brought in countries where either we haven't seen any case of strategic climate litigation or where there's been one or two, so an increase there as well.
The case in the Philippines was decided last month. The human rights investigators concluded that oil and gas companies could, in fact, be held responsible. That decision won't be legally binding, but activists hope it lays the groundwork for future court cases. Still, the courts themselves might not be the best place to fight the battle against rising carbon emissions, says Dennis von Berkel.
Courts can't make climate policies. Courts are obviously not the best institution to deal with these issues.
Von Berkel was one of the lawyers working on that landmark case in the Dutch courts that inspired climate lawsuits around the world.
What courts can do is they can look at the facts and they can say, well, here the government really crossed the line. And what we really want is for governments not to cross that line and to start acting in the interest of the people.
Von Berkel and others hope that the threat of lawsuits will at least nudge them in that direction. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Governments around the world today are reacting to the assassination of Iran's top military commander. Qasem Soleimani was killed when his convoy was hit by an American drone strike near the Baghdad airport. President Trump authorized it and defended the action this afternoon.
We took action last night to stop a war. We did not take action to start a war.
According to the Pentagon, Soleimani had been developing plans to attack Americans in Iraq and throughout the region. In response to the strike, Iran is promising severe revenge against the U.S. Iran's neighbor, Iraq, where the strike happened, is warning that today's assassination could lead to war. But another player in the region is applauding President Trump. Israel has long considered Soleimani to be the mastermind behind terrorist attacks against Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today readily came to the defense of the U.S.
President Trump deserves all the credit for acting swiftly, forcefully, decisively. Israel stands with the United States in its just struggle for peace, security, and self-defense.
Reaction from Europe, meanwhile, has not been so supportive, especially from countries that are signed onto the Iran nuclear deal. They want to keep that deal alive. Amélie de Montchalin is with France's Ministry for Europe and Foreign Affairs.
D'abord, c'est la suite d'une escalade qui dure depuis des mois.
It's the next step in an escalation which has been going on for months. What is happening is what we feared. Tensions between the United States and Iran are increasing.
A spokeswoman for the German government said Iranian provocations were partly to blame for escalating tensions in the region. Provocations like protests this week by an Iranian-backed militia outside the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. A spokeswoman with the German government, Ulrike Demmer, said her country wants to see a diplomatic solution.
Mit großer Besorgnis, wir sind an einem gefährlichen Eskalationspunkt.
We're at a dangerous escalation point, and it's important now to contribute to a de-escalation through prudence and restraint. The regional conflicts can only be resolved through diplomatic channels, and for this, we are in contact with our allies.
Meanwhile, China, another signatory to the Iran nuclear deal, is calling for calm. Here's the country's foreign ministry spokesman, Geng Shuang.
Iraq's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity should be respected, and peace and stability in the Middle East Gulf region should be maintained. We urge the relevant sides, especially the U.S., to remain calm and exercise restraint to avoid further escalating tensions.
And here in the U.S., the drone strike sharply divided congressional leaders along party lines. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said the strike was carried out without the consultation of Congress. She said, "We cannot put the lives of American service members, diplomats, and others further at risk by engaging in provocative and disproportionate actions." Many Republicans in Congress heaped praise on the president today. They said the assassination delivered swift justice. For Anna Eskamani, the killing of Iranian General Soleimani has made a tough situation even more difficult. Eskamani is a Democratic lawmaker in Florida's State House. She represents the Orlando area. She's also Iranian-American.
My first reaction is complete shock and concern. Concern for the lives of our American troops and officials abroad alongside innocent civilians in these countries is definitely where my mind is and where my heart is right now.
The news broke sometime yesterday evening. What did you do when you first heard that news? I know you've got family in Iran, right?
I do. One of the first things I did was actually reach out to my family through different social media platforms to see what their reactions are and how they are feeling. I did talk to one of my cousins last night who is concerned about the potential war between our two countries. A lot of rumors swirling in Iran right now as well about what the retaliation might be. Ultimately, there is a desire by many in Iran for a democratic Iran. And we know this country is one with a dark history of human rights violations, but I think we're all concerned in the future of a never-ending war, much like this our country has seen in the past.
In Iran, what do you think that might mean for communicating with your loved ones?
It becomes more and more challenging. And I think part of the struggle, too, when it comes to the Trump administration's approach to Iran is that so many of the decisions negatively impact innocent people. One example is the travel ban, which has prohibited thousands of Iranians from being able to stay connected to loved ones here in the United States, from attending university here in the United States, from visiting their family back in Iran. So at this point, when there's no end in sight to the travel ban, when there's no end in sight to escalation, so many Iranians feel like they're caught between two governments who don't care about them.
So in Florida, your Republican colleagues like U.S. Representative Michael Waltz tweeted that the killing was a, quote, bold, decisive, and frankly, long overdue move. U.S. Senator Rick Scott tweeted, "His death sends a clear message. Acts of aggression against the U.S. won't be tolerated." Those are pretty highly charged comments about a place where, as you said, you've got family. How do those words strike you?
There's no doubt that this general is and was an evil man. But setting the precedent of assassination in other countries to pursue what often feels more like a political agenda than one that is geopolitically smart or strategic is concerning to me. And it's concerning to anyone in this world who desires peace over war.
What are you hearing from your Iranian-American constituents in Florida, specifically those people?
Yeah. My district doesn't have a large Iranian-American community, but we've heard from Iranian-Americans across the country, and we've heard from our constituents who aren't Iranian-Americans. And the overarching consensus is no to war.
I'm curious, Representative Escomani, what space is there for you as a state lawmaker in Florida to address this issue thousands of miles away?
Sometimes you feel helpless, not just as someone who lives in the United States and is watching protesters be stifled abroad, is trying to talk to family when internet shuts down. I mean, it's all very personal at different levels. I think the biggest role that I can play is education, because I think there's also just a deep lack of understanding of the long history between the United States and Iran, whether it's pre-revolution or post-revolution. So I feel like part of my responsibility is to help teach what I know about the history between our two countries, and to also try to break bread over what we have in common. And actually, we hosted the first ever Persian New Year party in the Florida Capitol this past year. And we had 150 people attend, including many Republican lawmakers who might one day run for Congress and be in a position where they're going to make choices around foreign policy. So I think my hope as the first Iranian-American elected in any public office in Florida is to help foster that peace long term through ways we can find commonality and hopefully avoid any type of war today and in the future.
Anna Escomani is a Democratic lawmaker in the Florida State House of Representatives representing the Orlando area. Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us this Friday. We're back Monday, of course, and you can always catch us 24/7 at theworld.org and on our podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we say farewell today to a key person behind the scenes here, editor Jennifer Gorin, who for nearly 20 years has been working with our reporters to deliver the quality of storytelling you expect from us here at The World. Jennifer, we wish you only the best in your next chapter. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. Enjoy your weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.